Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Joining me now with his take on the state of the world on Donald Trump Day 97, Macron-Le Pen runoff Day 3, and Theresa May, re-election shocker, whatever day it is New York Magazine columnist Andrew Sullivan. As usual, his article these days can be taken as wake-up calls for both the right and the left. Andrew, thanks for doing this. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. It's great to be here.
Let me actually start on Britain, your country of origin. You write that Prime Minister May may have been quietly for Remain, but now she's a hard Brexiteer. Did she call for new elections, putting her own leadership on the line when she didn't have to reaffirm Brexit?
Absolutely. What she wants to do is both give herself a strong hand to negotiate Brexit with the European Union, but also she wants to prevent rogue Tories and other people in the House of Commons from resisting any compromise and putting her at risk at home. So she wants a big majority to strengthen her hand with Europe. She also sees an almost unique opportunity to destroy the Labour Party forever. The Tories are now ahead by roughly 20 points, and it's possible that Labour will be reduced to among its lowest showing since the 30s, may even be existentially driven out.
Does that mean that the British people, or not enough of them, or not many of them, have buyer's remorse about Brexit after the shock when it was passed?
No, there's no polling evidence that anybody who voted for leaving the EU is regretting it at all. What's happened is that since the decision was made, the most coherent position for the United Kingdom is to have a government that will actually pursue it with gusto and meaning and strength. And so what you've seen is the former United Kingdom Independence Party, the far right, actually rejoin the Conservatives. And you've seen the Labour Party, which, like the Democrats, is combined with sort of liberal elites in the cities, in London, but also its working class roots, its Rust Belt communities, are voting for Brexit, voted for Brexit. And so they are extraordinarily divided. And the Liberal Democrats are very weak. Currently, May is at something like 49%. That's a landslide possibility. Mm. In other words, that Britain is not moving back towards the EU. It's actually powerfully moving ahead against it.
How would you compare that to here? Because here at Day 97, Trump is so unpopular, although he doesn't seem to have lost hardly any support among people who voted for him, but his poll numbers in general, people seeing him as honest and trustworthy in the 30s, people don't like his policies. But you wrote that unlike the Trumpeteers, the British Tories have managed to channel populism into reasonably credible government. Plus, you say that the Labour Party is in such a free fall. So why is it so different?
Well, I think partly because Theresa May is not a radical, out-of-the-box, inexperienced celebrity politician. She was Home Secretary for 6 years. She's come up through the system. She has the ability for people to trust her as an actual capable leader, whereas Trump is obviously a complete disaster on that front. Secondly, you know, this country voted narrowly for Clinton in the national polling, in the actual election result, numerically, 48 to 46. In Britain, it was 52 to 48 for leaving the European Union. So the Brits already had a slight majority for leaving, and May has just simply capitalized on that.
I saw you on Meet the Press Daily last Friday and was struck by what you said, and I'm going to read for our listeners just a little bit of the transcript and ask you to elaborate. You said, Britain, in a year today, admits more people than it admitted from 1066 to 1950. It's adding 10,000 people a year to this civil island. Many of them don't speak English, come from all over the planet. You keep doing that to a country, it will eventually say, we're losing our sense of who we are. That's what's happening in France. On est chez nous is the campaign slogan for Le Pen. This is our home, and this is what I think you saw happening in America. These forces are so big that unless we understand them better, unless we restrain them more successfully, we're going to look back on Trump and be grateful. Is that a wake-up call from you for the left to understand today's white nationalism, if that's the right thing to call it, better, if it's going to successfully resist it?
Yes, it is. It's a worry that these forces are very strong. They're not, you can't really describe them simply as a bunch of racist white nationalists. They're responding in many ways to a multiplicity of factors. One, the sense of national identity disappearing, the fact that the United States is going to be the first ever majority white country in the history of the world to become majority non-white, and that is going to have some panic among people who think the meaning of their America is changing fast. That's combined with the fact that many of these people know, and they're right to know, that the global economy is pummeling them, will continue to pummel them, that the geographic isolation that these people have from the big successful metropolitan circles is going to intensify. It isn't going to get better. And these resentments which have given us Trump, which have given us Brexit, which have given us a record high number of votes for the Front National in France, these are not going away. They're going to get worse. And therefore, understanding these forces, not simply dismissing them, is absolutely crucial. And I fear that those of us who live in these rather successful multiracial, multicultural cities have missed out on what's really happening in the country at large. And then you see that in so many different countries right now, France especially. If you look geographically at where the divide is, you will see it primarily between the metropolises, which are a lot of very successful, cognitive elite, native French people, with an amazing variety of immigrants, multicultural elements, multiracial elements, who are also in some ways acting as almost a servant class to this new cognitive elite. The old French, the sort of white Americans, the white French, the sort of traditionalists, they're lost. They don't have an economic way forward. They see their national identity disappearing, and they are desperately searching for someone to represent them. And I think if the left doesn't understand that better and reach out to those people, if they intensify this division even further, then eventually there's a lot of those people, and they're going to have a real impact on our national politics in the future.
What would the left reaching out look like?
I think it would be stop condescending to these people, to these voters. Stop calling them deplorable, for example. Stop immediately thinking of them as entirely bigots and racists, and therefore to be dismissed. Stop thinking you can actually win in the long run with the kind of Obama coalition without someone of Obama's ability to bridge these gaps, to actually reach out to the center, as it were, in a way that Clinton couldn't. And the Democratic Party is now in a fight. Do we reach out to these people, or do we dismiss them and move on? I'm in favor of reaching out, partly because I think it may be more successful for the Democrats in the long run, and partly because I think it'd be better for the country. I think if this polarization, this geographical, economic, cultural polarization of the country continues, we're headed towards, you know, real civil conflict and political dysfunction.
Listeners, Andrew Sullivan, New York Magazine columnist, raising some big questions here. Who wants to engage? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. On Britain, on France, on the U.S., on the shared political and cultural and identity issues, as well as economic ones, 212-433-9692. Are you suggesting that slowing down the pace of immigration to the U.S., U.K., and France is not a racist policy and maybe even a good idea while some version of integration takes place over time?
Absolutely, I am. I also think that pausing free trade agreements And the expansion of free trade, which is pummeling this part of the community, is also a good idea. I think we should, I don't think the Democrats should be in any way ambivalent about enforcing immigration laws and keeping the border tight. I think that's one reason Clinton lost. That night at the convention where they were talking about immigration and had a big celebration of Latino culture, which is great, nonetheless, drew no distinction between legal and illegal immigrants. And for a lot of people out there, that is a real issue. And the Democratic Party has sort of put that on hold in order to build its base, its multiracial base. And I think that's a mistake, and that's why someone like Trump has this opening.
The pushback against that would argue mm-hmm. that the focus on illegal immigration is just because that's low-hanging fruit. What the Jeff Sessions, the Tom Cottons, the Donald Trumps of the world are really against is Mexicans in any large numbers. And so it's a little less politically acceptable, although Senator Cotton is proposing it, as Jeff Sessions did when he was a senator, to cut legal immigration in half. The easier way at it is to say, oh, there's 11 million people here illegally. We're not against immigration. We're against illegals. But it's really saying we're against Mexicans.
Well, I think the answer is to be both. It's to say that we want to control legal immigration more than we are currently. Look, the United States is now at a record high of foreign-born immigrants. I'm one of them. So I'm not speaking this from a nativist point of view. I'm an immigrant from another country, part of a wave of immigration. It's now at something like 14.9% of the entire population, which hasn't been reached since the 1890s through maybe the early 20th century. When that happened in the early 20th century, you had an incredibly draconian Immigration Act of 1924, which basically shut down immigration for the next 40 years,
right,
on the premise that we needed to integrate and assimilate people into a common national culture. And I think the key thing for the right now that works for them is that not only are the Democrats saying everybody's welcome, including illegals, essentially, they're also saying, and this country is not going to be an assimilationist country. It's going to be a multicultural country. The people are going to be able to have their own traditions outside of the American identity, that they're going to be able to speak Spanish, that they're going to be an entirely different cultural flavor to the country. The old doctrine of the melting pot has been changed by the left into one of the sort of globalized general identity of citizens of the world who just happen to be in the United States. And that adds extra fire to this particular divide.
Ari in Midwood, you're on WNYC with Andrew Sullivan. Hi, Ari.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call again. I just wanted to say I disagree with Andrew, because the thing is, I think we've heard the left, people in Democrats offering policies like job retraining, maybe basic income, stuff like that, to help, let's say, coal miners or people, the white working class. But they don't seem receptive to those policies. They seem to care more about their cultural issues than their economic values. We say, you know, a lot of people say how the right vote against their own interests. No, they just have different interests. So when we say, hey, let the government come in and try to help rebuild your communities, they say, no, well, we care more about gay marriage and abortion. And I literally listened to an NPR documentary last year before the Kentucky governor election. There was a woman who literally said that. She said, I'm going to vote for Matt Bevin, even though he said he wants to end the Kentucky healthcare exchange. And she said, but I'm going to vote for him because I care more about abortion and gay marriage. So I don't know how you can reach out to these people. We try, but they don't want what the left offers them.
Andrew?
Well, they are deciding. They believe that their cultural concerns, especially at this point, because I really do think in some ways the culture war has ended to some extent. In other words, I don't see within these new movements the religious right really being a powerful motivator. It's there, but it's not what's driving this right now. What's driving this right now is immigration, multiculturalism, and free trade, as well as the awful economic prospects for white, working, middle-class people, especially men, actually. Look, I think you can still make, I mean, the truth is that Obama tried to do exactly this, right? I mean, the ACA is really directed to helping the white working poor. Retraining, too, to some extent works, but most people in those regions realize it's not going to happen. We just don't have the vibrancy of that global cognitive economy that the cities are always going to have, so they despair of it. All I'm saying is that you can keep promoting those policies, but if you wrap them up in a bundle that culturally alienates, in fact affronts and terrifies people, then you're not going to get your message through. The message is right there. If you look at what's happened to the polling on the Affordable Care Act since the Republicans got in, it's gone up dramatically because people are looking at that question outside of, do I also have to support the entire cultural agenda of the Democratic Party? One has to remember that the Democrats have gone quite far to the left on many of these questions. I mean, Clinton ran the most pro-abortion campaign imaginable in ways that unnecessarily, in my view, offended many more traditional-minded people. Similarly, there's a fight in the Democratic Party of whether anybody who might differ from the pro-choice absolute position could even be considered a Democrat. Those are mistakes, I seem to think. You've got to keep reaching out. If you don't, this is my real problem, if you don't, or if the center-right doesn't come up with a real alternative to these people, you're going to have more Trumps, you're going to have more Le Pens, you're going to have more things like Brexit in the future. Because there are a lot of these people, and riled up enough, they will win elections.
Kathy in Bay Ridge, you're on WNYC. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
My dad came here in the 50s. He was illegal. My mom was from Pittsburgh. She was born here, both Greek. My mom's family is from Lesbos, which has been overrun with the Syrian immigrant problem, and it's destroying Lesbos. However, my dad came here illegally. She helped him to figure out how to become legal. I don't know what steps they took, but ultimately he became an American citizen and then brought his siblings over, and they all became American citizens. I think that we should all continue to see that people can be here legally. If they're coming here and they're not legal, then are we really a nation of laws? I mean, then it's just a free-for-all, it seems.
When you say Lesbos, and I'm not familiar with it in particular as, a destination for Syrian immigrants or what the impact
right
of that is.
It's right next to Turkey. It's literally right next to Turkey.
But when you say it's being overrun or being destroyed, why? How?
At this point, I'm not as up on it as I was, a couple months ago. But they were coming in boats, just in flows and flows of them, like hundreds of them a day, just coming over from the Middle East. Which, like I said, Turkey. If you're in Lesbos, and we were there a couple of years ago, my daughter and myself, and we were driving around, we were getting radio stations from Turkey that were clearer than any of the Greek stations. So they were coming up in rafts, the same way that we had that sort of thing happening here from Cuba back in the 80s, Haiti was it, I think. There were a lot of people coming in by rafts, and the Greek people were welcoming them and setting up all sorts of camps for them, and those camps, I believe, still exist. But unfortunately, they've overrun Lesbos in such a way that I've seen from what my relatives have been telling me, that the area, Lesbos was a beautiful island, and now it's being destroyed as far as not destroyed because these people are there, but being destroyed because there's been things happening, like people are destroying property, private property, throwing rocks at people who own their houses, and I don't know. It's just it's a tinderbox. It's not a good situation. When you have that kind of uncontrolled immigration happening, people, the Greeks wanted to welcome them. And at the same time, once all these people were there, there were a lot of tensions that started to develop.
Kathy, thank you for your call. Andrew, you familiar with that situation? And
yes,
do we take anything bigger out of that particular humanitarian crisis, which, we can't say is happening probably with that intensity elsewhere in the world, or too easily compare it to ordinary immigration, right?
Yes, to some extent, although when Merkel admits 1.5 million Syrian refugees in one fell swoop and has absolutely no concerns about the ability to assimilate and integrate that group of people, many of them coming from backgrounds that are very different from Western society, then she is provoking and has provoked, I think, throughout Europe, a concern that, look, you're pushing this too far and too fast. It's not a question of whether a multiracial society can work. I think it can. But accept human nature. People don't want to see their entire culture and what they've recognized as what it means to be English or German or French or even or American suddenly transformed in ways they cannot control. I mean, for example, London is now 58% non-white. So that when the general white English people show up in London, they really don't recognize it as their own capital city anymore. It seems like an international megalopolis of hundreds of different languages, of millions of different religions. There are more mosques opening, and churches are closing.
Why isn't pluralism in and of itself the definition of a major cosmopolitan city like London?
Well, it's never been done at this level, at this pace, with these numbers before in human history, and certainly not in a small island like England. This kind of transformation, 600,000 people a year immigrating into a country of 60 million, a quarter of births in Britain are now to immigrants. The most popular baby name for boys in England, do you know what it is?
Nope.
It's Muhammad. These are, these are cultural things that if you don't, what I'm saying is if you don't have an understanding of basic human nature, we're all tribal, we have in-group, out-group feelings. If you ignore that entirely and you push this at a pace and a rapidity that we are, and you combine that with economic stagnation for many of these people, you have a recipe for neo-fascism everywhere, if you're not careful. And look around the world. What do we see ascendant? This is what we see ascendant. So my view is that let's get real about this. Let's be honest about human nature. Let's be honest that culture does matter, that people need some sort of national identity for their own meaning, and ease up a little. Slow the pace down. Allow people to integrate more. Don't have this multicultural agenda in which no one need immigrate at all, assimilate at all, and you won't have this backlash. In other words, human beings are still human beings, and you present them with too rapid a change, too big a cultural change, they're going to personally and psychologically react. This is a reactionary era, Brian, everywhere. And our job is to figure out how to slow down, arrest, and manage to co-opt these forces rather than dig ourselves into a hole and let them take over everything, which I think is extremely possible, even in France. I don't buy that Macron has really solved this problem. Macron and his agenda is an almost affront, a direct attack on the regional, generally white voting base. That's why the far left is not supporting him in the second round. When he wants even more European integration, when he says there's no such thing as French culture, when he says that Islamist terrorism is just something we have to get used to, these things are not in any way attempting to persuade or engage a lot of people in France. He will almost certainly win this time. But next time, if he pursues those policies, that's what I'm concerned with, Brian. I'm not in favor of this. I'm worried that we are in denial about its power, its attractiveness, and its ubiquity.
Omid in Bridgeport, you're on WNYC with Andrew Sullivan. Hi, Omid.
Hi. I just want to say that this idea of appeasing xenophobia and racism is incredibly offensive to the people who basically have to face that kind of problem on it every day. And it's really disturbing seeing so many people in essentially just white people in media, New York Times, very prominent and highly regarded newspapers basically arguing to basically back off on accepting differences and other people, just so that people who are feeling xenophobic and particularly racist can feel a little more normal and maybe not elect people like Trump. I don't see how that works at all.
Andrew, talk to Omid.
Well, does the alternative work? That's my question. Has it worked to call all the Trump voters bigots and racists and misogynists? Has that persuaded them in any way? You now have a Republican president, a Republican Senate, Republican House. You know, a vast majority of the states in this country, a large majority are now governed by Republican legislatures, and yet still you call them racists. Do you think that they're going to respond in any way constructively to that description?
I don't think there would be necessarily a constructive response to that, but I actually would argue that the country at large hasn't called these people racist. There's been massive pushback against that. The whole basket of the Pro Bowl, she had to retract that statement. During the entire election, there was this pretense that these voters were voting for Trump based on economic insecurities, when you can see that that's not the case based on the economic level that most of his voters were on. And the simple fact that newspapers right now are struggling to explain how it is that these voters don't regret voting for Trump, despite the fact that every economic thing he's done is going to hurt the middle class and those that are struggling economically. But the one thing he's managed to deliver on is his promises of xenophobia, racism, demonizing everyone who isn't white and Christian. He's fully delivered on that. He's tilting the Justice Department towards becoming the old racist Justice Department and fighting a battle for Christians in this fake war on Christianity. That's what's happening right now. So his voters are happy because they didn't actually care about the economic issues. What drove their votes was this racism and xenophobia. And
well,
our press still doesn't seem to be acknowledging that.
Andrew,
I agree with you. Mm-hmm. I agree with you. What's really fueling this is cultural, not necessarily economic, but the cultural shift of reaction to a suddenly different racial and cultural composition of the country is intensified by economic dislocation and a sense of economic despair. So that we agree on what's happening. The question is how we respond to it. And my view is that you can call it racism, and I think you'd be right in many respects. But you could also see that human beings desire and need some national identity. And that national identity, if it changes too quickly, too fast, will prompt a backlash. It's always done that in American history. It's done that. And what's happening today, the demographic transformation of this country is far greater than most people seem to understand. It really is an astonishing shift from where we were when baby boomers were being born. It just is. And those people are reacting to that. You also notice that in France, for example, this response is also among the young. Le Pen is doing extremely well upon young French who are in the suburbs, who are not that technically and cognitively advanced, who aren't that well educated, who nonetheless feel that they're being ignored and also condescended to. When you say to those people, as the left does, you're actually privileged, that seems to me to be incredibly counterproductive. They sure don't feel that way. And I'm just arguing for a less rigid approach to understanding the genuine concerns of people who are growing up or emerging into a country they don't quite recognize as their own and feel that the power has shifted away from them to this particular demographic and to this particular coalition. I think it's just a process, but I think that if you put their backs up against a wall, as the left seems to be doing, then you're going to be counterproductive. That's really my argument. It's not to defend this, although I do think that human beings, we're tribal people, and the nation state matters. And our identity with that nation, its culture, its history, its meaning through the ages, is a crucial integrate us socially and culturally. And if you shake that up and disperse it or treat it with complete contempt, the response is going to be as furious as it is all over the Western world. And this is a real question.
To our caller, Omid, thank you for engaging. To Andrew Sullivan, New York Magazine columnist, big provocative thoughts on the big provocative questions that are roiling the United States, the UK, and France at very least right now. And thank you very much for coming on.
Brian, thank you very much. Next Monday, actually, I have a cover story coming out about the new reactionarism, which kind of teases. The reason I'm talking about this lately is because I'm working on this big piece. So I hope to make the argument in greater depth and nuance in the magazine next week.
In next week's New York Magazine. Thanks again.
You bet, Brian. Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Winona LaDuke next. Stay with us.